And to this event, I'm Erik Bergloff. I'm a director of the Institute of Global Affairs. I have a very simple role here tonight because I'm supposed to introduce Anne Applebaum, and of course she needs no introduction because that's why you're here. But you know, you all know her from her columns in Washington Post. I'm sure many of you follow her on Twitter. Perhaps the most interesting Twitter person to follow, but she's actually, you know, done so much more. And you know her book that gave her the Pulitzer Prize on the Gulag, which certainly changed my perception of the Gulag, and I think it changed many others and left a legacy of very significant importance. Basically, every book of hers have been changing the way we look at things. Her book on the Iron Curtain, which described the Sovietization of Eastern Europe, is a landmark. I think no one can think of this period again without having that book in mind. So she's here tonight because she has joined LSE and the Institute of Global Affairs as a professor in practice. She has set up the ARENA program. I let her introduce that program, but it's about an issue that she comes to both as a historian, as someone who's intensely engaged in issues of the present. If you have come across her recent book, which I strongly recommend, Red Famine, which looks at the history of Ukraine, and particularly a period in the early 30s when Ukraine went through a horrific famine, which was very much imposed on it from the Soviet leadership at the time. But what is so striking with that book is that it talks about disinformation and the active use of disinformation and fake news, and it feels so current in that regard. And of course, you can view that book as a sort of case study in disinformation and fake news. And Anne came to LSE to promote research, policy engagement around this incredibly important issue where that's really challenging democracy as we know it in the West, but it also is a phenomenon, as we know, in many authoritarian countries as well. So without further ado, we have a fantastic panel, and I'm going to give the floor to Anne. So very welcome to LSE, Anne, and please, the floor is yours.
Thank you for that incredibly generous and introduction, Erik. I'd like to welcome you all to the LSE and to the Institute for Global Affairs and to our new program, ARENA, which is a program that was set up directly to deal with the issues of democracy and disinformation and what we're going to do about it. I'm empowered to tell you that there will be a podcast made, probably, barring some technical difficulties, so could you please turn your phones off in case they're on. I'm also glad to be able to say that after the event, we'd like to invite you all to a reception afterwards. I'll give you directions at the end of the evening as to where to go. I will do a brief introduction to the subject. We then have a really spectacularly good panel. We have Liam Byrne, who is the Shadow Minister for the Digital Economy, has had a number of other roles in the previous Labour government, and will no doubt have many roles in the future, but has made this issue really one of his special subjects. We also have Joanna Shields, Baroness Shields, who worked for 25 years in Silicon Valley before coming to be first an advisor to David Cameron, and she's now the Prime Minister's Special Representative for Internet Safety. And of course, I'm really glad, above all, to have my colleague and the co-founder of ARENA, Peter Pomerantsev, who is probably the best-known expert on the Russian propaganda state we have, who wrote a wonderful book called Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, the title of which gives you some hint as to the nature of the book. You know, what is ARENA? ARENA was, is, so I don't come from a think tank or an academic or a, really a policy background. As you heard, I'm a journalist and I'm a historian. But I did come to realize a few years ago, actually I can claim to have thought about this before the US election, that there was beginning to be a very big problem with organized disinformation campaigns that exist online and that are beginning to have a huge effect on not just on elections but on democracy in general. I saw them happen first in Central and Eastern Europe, in Ukraine, but not only. And I began to ask myself, you know, why are so many elections in so many democracies taking such striking turns? Why are nationalists and xenophobes who all sound the same suddenly gaining support in countries that have very different economics and very different political problems and different political histories, you know, whether it's Poland or the Philippines or the United States. And I also realized a few years ago that just as the printing press broke the monopoly of the monks in the 15th century, that the internet and social media within the space of really a very few years have undermined not only the business model of the democratic media, political media that has been in operation for the past couple of centuries, but also the political institutions that they have been, that they are connected to. And if you look around the world, you can see that large newspapers and powerful broadcasters are much weaker than they were, and there are good things about that and bad things about it, just like there were good and bad things about the printing press. And these are, you know, these are old-fashioned organizations that might have had many flaws, but many of them had as their founding principle at least a theoretical commitment to objectivity and at least a theoretical commitment to fact-checking and to the public interest, and they served, therefore, as a filter, eliminating egregious conspiracy theories. More importantly, they also created the possibility of a national debate. And in many democracies, there is now no common debate, let alone a common narrative. People don't have the same facts. One group thinks that one set of things is true, another thinks another. You know, and we all now know, I think some of this was new to people 2 or 3 years ago, but it's now clear that both the weakness of the media and the nature of social media has created these homogenous clusters online where people get their news from their close-knit, ideologically similar friends, and they interpret news through common lens. And this phenomenon has contributed to the growth of hyper-partisanship and intense polarization. This has many effects. It's led people to helped contribute to distrust in normal politics and politicians. It's undermined political parties, the existing political parties. It's led to a plethora of ironic and parodic and joke political candidates winning elections. And it has also been, it has also proved an excellent conduit for the spread of false rumors. I just read another paper yesterday by an Italian researcher describing how you can almost measure the people who are most likely to read and circulate false stories or to respond to organized disinformation campaigns are the people who are the most polarized and who live in the most narrow echo chambers. And so there is a connection between the nature of social media and the way in which these campaigns work. We know quite a lot now about how Russian disinformation works, you know, thanks partly to the US election, but partly to what we knew before. We know that it has focused on emphasizing and amplifying extreme narratives, which you know, the Russian state and other actors do in other ways as well, but we know that they do it online. We knew that they seek to spread extreme language and to publicize and amplify extreme groups. We also know that because this is a part of domestic politics and in a way is using the openness of the internet and using the existing divides in society, you know, as a form of political combat, as a way of both of weakening democracy but also of ensuring or helping to encourage certain kinds of outcomes, we know that it's very, very difficult for traditional institutions to cope with this kind of activity. It's very difficult for, NATO, which was set up to deal with outside threats to our democracies, is not really set up, in fact, is certainly not set up to deal with, social media campaigns inside its member states. Democratic governments are very reluctant to intervene, given our commitment to freedom of speech. All the organizations and people, the Foreign Office, even the security services who are meant to be dealing with these kinds of issues, have had trouble with them. And that was one of the things that inspired the creation of ARENA, I'm going to turn over the conversation to Peter in just a second to explain some of the things that we're going to try to do, but we are essentially looking to both to begin to spark conversation about this. We talk to a lot of different people in different governments and different institutions to inspire search for solutions, but also are starting to do some online experiments with data and with journalism to see if we can, put back together this. You know, we have this very segmented population. Are there ways of ending that segmentation? I should say that I said a few words about Russia. This is, of course, not just a Russian problem. Although the Russians were the first to invest in some of this, lots of people are going to follow them, other governments, other political movements, private companies. There is no big bar of entry to the game of creating and pushing disinformation campaigns. It doesn't cost very much. It doesn't take very much time. It's not particularly high tech, and it requires no special equipment. So, although we will, I'm sure, refer to Russia several times this evening, try and think of this as a societal problem that's going to have a lot of aspects. And imagine that we're really right at the beginning. So we've just invented the printing press, and the religious wars are still to come. And now I'm going to let Peter introduce ARENA's projects, and then we'll move on to our discussion. Thank you very much.
In the spirit of the Reformation, we're going to get rid of priests and move it down to the to the public. So the idea for ARENA, apart from these sort of very sort of high level ideas that Anna's introduced, came when I was discussing the phenomenon of why are kittens so popular on the internet, with a rather brilliant Italian academic and data scientist. And he had a whole theory about why kittens are so popular on the internet. He'd done a huge amount of research into what he calls emotional narratives on social media. So how do people behave emotionally when they're in a Facebook group or in a Twitter feed, usually, a Twitter kind of community? And he found the emotions always went from positive to negative. And I don't know if you've noticed this. I've noticed this in my Facebook communities. Certainly see it a lot online, on Twitter. People just becoming angrier and angrier. And these civilized discussions sort of melting into these, rabid fights. And he was trying to work out, why does this happen? And look, he's an academic, so I have to take his theory seriously. And his whole idea was that essentially, and I think he does use the term loosely, social media is a narcissism machine. You're not going there for knowledge. You're not going there for debate. You're going there for self-confirmation in the forms of likes and shares and retweets. But you can never quite have enough of that little ego boost that you're looking for, yeah? And so you become angrier and angrier as you're looking for more and more confirmation that you can't get. I mean, I've heard some narcotics act on people in a similar way. And that's why people go from being quite normal to being very, very angry. And at that point of, unsatisfied egomania, the sight of something helpless, cuddly, that you can feel empowers you, gives you a kind of a dopamine or kind of a morphine hit instead of the drug that you really want, so thus kittens. So kittens betrayed something very, very disturbing about the nature of the internet. It's not about public debate. It's not about a public democratic space. It's about what we now call sort of echo chambers, about looking for confirmation bias, and that sort of fuels increased polarization, which is rather tragic, because we always thought that the internet would be great for deliberative democracy, but actually it's fueled this world of a lack of mutual understanding. And as I and this academic sort of started talking, like, oh my God, what can we do about it? It turns out that sort of the data environment is reducing the potential for democracy. And clearly, you know, some groups have cottoned onto this. What's been so sort of amusing and yet distressing when we see sort of the evidence of the Kremlin's campaigns in America is how they choose polarized topics like Black Lives Matter and do Facebook messages on both sides. Yeah, it's not about ideology anymore. It's not about winning ideas. It's about fueling polarization. And so we got into a discussion about how can we use data for good? This can't be sort of an infinite regression into mutual hatred. And so that's where Arena was born, this challenge, like, can we actually not run away from the technology, not hide from it, embrace it and somehow use it for good? So a year later, we've just launched a project, literally this week, with the academic I just mentioned, who runs a wonderful, I love the names that these people have, like a lab for data science and complexity at the University of Venice. And we've just started a project, which is one small step, and kind of reflects our philosophy, I think, in many ways. So we're going to look at echo chambers around migration in Italy, which is a very, very contentious theme in Italy. It's very deeply polarizing and used to divide the debates, one where a lot of misinformation exists. And so you have this sort of, we're creating a map of what different groups in Italy feel about migration, how they talk about it, where misinformation really breeds in some of these within some of these groups. And then we're going to work with Corriere della Sera for a year. And they're going to try to write about migration in a way that brings people who at the moment want to murder each other, not into consent, because that would be not what we're after at all, but into some point where they start listening and talking to each other. How can Corriere della Sera start to write about migration in ways where people who are misinformed are ready to deal with the facts and have a conversation around the issue, which is fact-driven? Corriere della Sera are the big sort of daily in Italy, in case you don't know. So that's what we do. We take data people, we take journalists, we try to put them together and try to see whether essentially we can reinvent media and save democracy, which is our modest aim. Not just journalists that we're working with, though, because we come from journalism, that's an interesting place for us to be. Very interesting, how can we refresh public diplomacy? How can public diplomats start talking to populations, I don't know, in Ukraine and Eastern Europe, which have become deeply cynical about, you know, conversations about democracy? How can they engage with them? And of course, we're continuing to look at foreign campaigns within democracies to try to understand more about them, but always, I think, with a view to what does that tell us about our own information space? What are the different gaps in it, and how can we close those gaps and bring society closer together? So we have a couple of publications which are already up on our site. One of them is a historical view, looking at how the West, which probably isn't a thing that exists anymore, but did then, dealt with Soviet disinformation campaigns, and what are the lessons that we can employ from that time until now. It's not easy at all. There's very few things which are still the same. There are some interesting stories to get out of there. And another thing that's up on our site already is an analysis that we did of the German election, which I'll just leave sort of one little story from that with you and before Joanna and Liam take over. So we were trying to look at, well, it was interesting. We were meant to look at Kremlin influences in the German election. But as soon as we got into the subject, we realized that everybody was at it. The American alt-right were on it. The Swedish far-right were getting involved. The Falun Gong were running their own campaign. It was basically this chaos. So some colleagues of ours at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, they actually went undercover. Dramatic pause. And entered into where the US alt-right and the German far-right were planning their campaigns to turn the German election towards the far-right party, the AfD. Or are they far-right? The Nationalist Right Party, the AfD. And so these different groups, Americans and Germans and Swedes, were getting together. They were creating war rooms on closed gaming channels. From there, they were kind of handing out memes. They were giving instructions how you hack into the hashtags of the opposite parties and make the hashtags actually reflect your points of view. They were given instructions as how you kind of disguise yourself as if you were actually a member of a different party, go online, start a campaign, and then twist it towards what the AfD wants, and so on and so forth, sort of a civic war room for the far right. Now, some of the memes that they were making, which were taken from the Americans, they were sort of ads for the German far-right party that were using the image of Keck. I don't know if everyone know who Keck is. Whatever, it's a US alt-right meme of a frog that's meant to fire up support for the far-right. It's a long story. Doesn't matter. They launched these sort of this ad campaign online on Twitter. And it went much better than they expected. And there was this wonderful moment that our researchers had when they were like, hold on, how come our campaign is going so well? And they realized that actually a team of Russian bots, which they hadn't engaged with themselves, had started supporting their campaign and was fueling the alt-right campaign. They're like, oh, they're a bit disappointed. They're like, we thought we were doing it. And they're like, okay, the Russians are helping. Fair enough. So we did another bit of investigative Germany and managed to find the Russian who was the Russian botnet manager who was helping fuel this online campaign. And he was a very strange bloke. He was actually surprisingly open. He didn't just do political campaigns. He did ads for escorts in Dubai. He did smear campaigns against Russian opposition politicians. And he did support for the alt-right and in Germany. And we kind of asked, so, you know, how much have they paid you? He's like, oh, I'm doing it for free. We have mutual interests. But that image that we were kind of left with you know, the US alt-right working together with the German right, helped with a Russian bot network that was simultaneously pushing escorts in Dubai, I think kind of caught the wonderful information chaos or the frightening information chaos that we work in. But the point is that the people who don't really like deliberative democracy are starting to coordinate very, very actively online. You know, they've really grasped this moment, both state actors and non-state actors. While on our side, I feel there's still a little bit of slowness. And the reason we wanted Joanna and Liam here was so that they could talk about what are the things that we could start doing, what are the things that have been tried already, what are the regulatory issues, the legal issues, the sort of the policy issues, in order to start, which we need to employ to start getting to grips with this problem.
Great. Thank you, Peter. So, yes, we are obviously a sort of academic, independent institution. We don't have the power and the money either of the government or of the tech companies. But as I said, we have two people here who have connections, however distant, to the power and the money of the government and the tech companies. And we'd like both of them, we wanted them to come here and reflect. You know, aside from our projects, which, as you heard, are both analytical and also a little bit experimental, you know, what about some of the bigger issues? And I think I might just start with Joanna, who worked for many years at Facebook and Google. And would you, you know, could you give us some hint about what you think is happening inside those companies? And we've heard Mark Zuckerberg make cryptic and kind of gnomic references to these terrible problems that are being caused by Facebook, which seem to be, you know, he's unsure what the solutions are. What's the conversation like in Silicon Valley, and how do you hear it in the British government?
Well, I don't want to speak. I'm not here to speak for the British government.
No, she's not speaking for the British government.
I'm actually an expert tonight. But around the time of the U.S. election, like just before the primaries, what I noticed here when we were, you know, when we were looking at Twitter and various other things, we were noticing that Make America Great Again was trending. Now, remember at the time, so late 2015, 2016, the world was focused on Islamist extremists influencing young people to travel to Syria. So a lot of the work that we were doing in government was working with the technology companies to try to understand how these nefarious forces were operating online on social media platforms, on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, you know, Telegram, and others. How these narratives were resonating with a community such that so many Western young people were traveling to Syria. So this was an existential, you know, crisis. We had terror attacks. We had threats of terror attacks. We had, you know, Adnani making prognostications about how he was telling people to act out in their communities if they couldn't travel. So these were really big issues. So this was happening simultaneously. So that's one force in motion. Then you have all of the campaigning, and, you know, we had the Brexit debate here. We had the U.S. election. And I have to say that the technology companies were not focused on the possibility of the algorithms that they use that are at the core of their business being weaponized by political forces. They were much more focused on this issue of the Daesh online. So at one point, there were you know, Facebook had a lot of editors that were looking to try to identify this material. And the conservative alt-right criticized them. So they looked at that policy and said, we're going to eliminate human editors and we're going to let the machine do it. But what they didn't understand or anticipate was how the machine would amplify this hyper-partisanship and how they basically, allowing the machine to take over, enabled the echo chamber to be much more vociferous. And you found that, you know, over time it became, you know, obvious. But after the election, I mean, even the first comments from Facebook after the election were, Mark said it's a pretty crazy idea that this could have happened. And now, I mean, the last thing I heard is there are over 200 million fake accounts on Facebook. And the problem is growing. You know, the last I heard it was like 14% up month on month. I mean, they're having a really serious problem dealing with these forces that have now figured out how to leverage this machine that advertisers have found so successful in amplifying passions of people and connecting messages with groups of people who would be interested in those messages, and how that's really turned into a hyper-partisan bifurcation.
Yeah, my impression is that they were initially, and to some extent still are, reluctant to deal with this because this runs right into their business model.
Yeah.
I mean, what were they set up to do? They were set up to amplify advertising campaigns, and the idea that that would turn into an amplification of political advertising campaigns seems to have not occurred to anybody. I mean, even though, as I said, you could see it in other countries well before 2016, but it wasn't really until there was a problem in the U.S. election that it became front and center. But I don't have the sense yet, I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, that they are, and this is, by the way, not just Facebook, but it's Google, it's Twitter.
When I say
it's really
Facebook, I mean Instagram, all the whole.
Yeah, but I don't have the sense yet that they have, you know, grappled with the scale of the problem, but you may have a different sense.
I don't see how they can, to be honest. I don't understand how the algorithm that's at the core of the business could, unless they chose to monitor the network using natural language processing and machine learning engines, classifiers that identified extremist-type content that would violate the terms of
service. Just theoretically possible. I mean, they
saw it's more than theoretically possible. I mean, you know, any good data scientist could build and train a classifier to identify this type of material. And, you know, it is easily done, but puts them in a completely impossible situation to be where they are the arbiters of truth, which I don't feel is a position that they would ever want to put themselves in.
Or maybe that we want them to be in.
Yeah.
Liam, Is should the government step in? Is there a role for government in regulating? I know that there are a number of European countries, Germany already, and I think France is going to be next, and maybe the EU after that, that are going to be looking at, are there ways to regulate the social media companies? What do you think?
Yeah, we're at that point. I mean, let me just sort of say three things, I guess, by way of introduction. I mean, first is to absolutely welcome this initiative. I mean, here at the LSE, your motto is to know the causes of things. Let me tell you tonight, as a practicing politician who has to win votes and get re-elected, you cannot understand what is going on in our democracy today without understanding this debate. It is impossible. So the power and the value of this initiative is really very, very significant. Second, I suppose, the reason that it's now kind of mega urgent is that as Joanna said, you know, this challenge started around Islamic extremism and ISIS, but actually now you've got a state actor involved called Russia. And, you know, when I was sitting in seats like these back in 1989, there was a very different kind of mood. Gorbachev was on the scene. He was talking about creating in Europe this common European home, a defined legal space. And those days are absolutely gone now. And that has huge implications for what we in the West now have to do, both to contain Russia, to confront Russia, but also to consolidate our own values here in this country. And at the core of those values have got to be values around free speech and the defense of democracy. Now, over the last kind of 2 or 3 months, sort of partly inspired by these guys' work, we've unpicked what we call the dark social playbook. And we thought it was most interesting to look at it in the context of the raw attack on what the Telegraph and the Mail have called the Brexit mutineers. So we looked at this. We looked at the ecosystem that basically starts with a bunch of fake news sites. It's often fueled by state-backed hackers. That will then find its way onto Twitter. Once a row is cooking on Twitter, you will get troll farms, robo-trolls kick in to dial up the volume. And then once the pot is really boiling, it gets sucked into Facebook, where dark money is then switched on behind the ads. And we found that the Brexit mutineers story had about 25 times more traffic on Facebook than it did on Twitter. Now, who paid for these ads? Well, the ads are paid for by a strange company called Voter Consultancy Limited. Go to company's house, the accounts are dormant. So where did the money come from? So unless you can really begin to understand this, you don't really know what is going on in our democracy. And now we know that Russia is really fueling this with a kind of a new generation of robo-trolls that kind of almost act as social media shock jocks on both sides of the equation. So on the one hand, one of the narratives they're pushing is Islamic extremism is undermining the stability of Europe. On the other hand, the other narrative they're pushing is there is a rise of new neo-Nazis in Europe. So that kind of clash of civilizations is absolutely at the core, that confusion that they want to sow. And that contributes to the reality that 30 million people voted for far-right nationalist parties last year. And a little over 12 years ago, one of those voters shot and killed one of my colleagues on the streets of her constituency in Yorkshire. So this is kind of profoundly serious for us. And I think there are probably 4 or 5 things that we now need to do as a country in response. So the first is obviously around digital literacy. And actually, digital literacy is pretty good. So when I do workshops with kids in schools in Hodge Hill, so I serve the corner of East Birmingham. It's the biggest Muslim constituency in Britain. It's the most income-deprived constituency in Britain. When I talk to 13-year-old kids, actually, they're reading the New York Times online. I need to kind of get them onto the Washington Post, but I'm sort of working on that. Digital literacy is pretty good. Obviously, you know, the more the better. Public service broadcasting has to step up. I mean, the fact that the BBC had stepped back from a Russian language service a few years ago, the fact that there were significant cuts to the World Service, significant cuts to the British Council, you know, we have to reverse those things and actually put significant new investment into our traditions of free speech. There's a number of things that government has to do. So I was a Home Office Minister for 2 years, in the 2 years after Operation Overt in 2006, which was the plot to kill 10,000 people by bringing down a bunch of airliners. And if you look at what we did in the kind of months after that, Contest was completely overhauled. We shipped out prisons to the Ministry of Justice. We created the Office of Security and Counterterrorism. We overhauled Prevent. We created the Proto National Security Council. I mean, there was a massive whole of government response to that. And actually, right now, it's pretty difficult to get from the government any news about the changes they're making to the mechanisms of government to do a better job of this. The fourth big thing, though, is we're going to have to change the e-commerce directive. So, you know, this is a bit of European legislation that basically allows social media companies to operate as platforms rather than publishers. I don't think people want us to switch them over to become pure publishers suddenly like The Guardian, but there is going to be a place in between. We're going to have to kind of roll back some of the anonymity and insist on the transparency that these social media firms were supposed to bring in the first place. And, you know, this is not like a one-off that we just kind of do and fix. This is like the factory acts of the 19th century. There wasn't one factory act in the 19th century. There were 17 of them. And they, you know, rolled out over the course of the century, and they were haggled over and debated and argued for and voted. And that's where we are now. There's going to be at least 17 versions of the e-commerce directive over the course of the 21st century. But the time to start is now. Final thing that I think we need to do is, as a country, we need to think a little bit more holistically and a little bit more forensically about what our rights in this space are. I mean, we've put out a proposal this week about what does a digital bill of rights look like for the 21st century. I don't know what it should be, and it shouldn't be me who comes up with it. I mean, we'll start kicking it around in the data protection bill when it comes to the Commons in a couple of weeks' time. But we need to have that debate now. What does a digital bill of rights look like for the 21st century? The final word I kind of offer, really, I suppose, is a line from a German journalist who was writing at the end of the Weimar Republic back in 1933, and he said at the time that, you know, Germany had a pretty good democracy, it just didn't have enough good Democrats, and the challenge that we have got today is actually, for all its challenges, we have a pretty good democracy, but we need a hell of a lot more Democrats, and we need to start democratizing the online space too.
I was wondering if I could pick up something that you mentioned, and that's a pretty live live topic of debate among everybody who talks about this big area of the tech companies, their relationship to government, and so on. And this is this question of anonymity. Mm. I've heard it argued that if you eliminated anonymity on Twitter, you would eliminate most of the problem. You would eliminate the bots, you would eliminate the people who are fake, and you would eliminate most of the trolling, because most of that's done by anonymous accounts. Is there a role for, I mean, this is really a question directed to both of you and to Peter, and maybe to somebody who's in the audience, who I'll ask to talk about in a second. Is there a role for the government in this? Is this a conversation that we should be having? I mean, it's something that I've thought about a little bit, because, you know, all of our law, our legal systems, you know, in America, the Constitution here, we give human rights and we give freedom of speech to actual people. But, you know, do we give those same rights to anonymous bots, you know, or to anonymous trolls? Is that something that we should be talking about restricting, or is this something the social media companies should be thinking about if they don't want to be regulated? Really, either one of you or Peter, if you'd like to talk about that. I ask it because it's a live question that comes up a lot and that people have usually quite a lot to say about.
So as you know, I was in Latvia on Monday at the NATO Stratcom facility there, and the line so they think something like 52%, in the last quarter they looked at, 52% of English language tweets about NATO and Baltic states were produced by bots. 52%. Russian language is over 75%. And I was being teased by the guy briefing me. He said, so, you know, you're a politician, you like to go on Twitter because you want to have your finger on the pulse, and the thing you don't realize is that you got your finger on a robot's pulse.
Yeah, that's right.
And there's a couple of things you can do. So there is definitely something around transparency of geotagging. So if you're trying to track down dangerous people, actually it's quite helpful to know where they're sending their stuff from. But second, you know, there is value in transparency around anything that is politically related. So how do you? So for example, you don't need an imprint on a digital bit of political advertising today. If I put a leaflet through your door, it's got to have my name and address and my agent on the bottom of it. Otherwise, you know, I get fined a lot and booted out of office. If I put that online, if I hire SCL or Cambridge Analytica and fire that ad at you on Facebook or on Twitter, then actually I don't have to put anything on it. You don't. We could pretend it comes from some of your mates, you know. So that's a level of transparency, I think. And then there's a real question about how do social media firms actually make it clear that something has been robo-trolled. I mean, I don't know how they do that. I'm sure the technology is there, but I think you've got the right to know whether what you're reading comes from someone with a pulse or someone without one.
But Joanna, according to what you just said there, social media companies have no interest in trying to do this. What do you think about it?
Well, I feel like that they have a hierarchy of challenges. And like, for instance, I just noticed on this issue, you know, there were like 27 Joanna Shields that had my picture and various pictures that were available from me the other day just on Facebook. And I noticed it because I kept getting all these Messenger, I kept getting all these people saying, oh, you've connected with me. And I hadn't connected with any of them. And then I looked, and I hadn't looked for a long time. And, you know, there were these are so sophisticated that they basically assemble profiles that have my photos that are out there in the universe, and pictures of Mark Zuckerberg and various other people, and it looks real. And, you know, and I wrote to Facebook and reported them all. You know, you go through that reporting tool, and I don't think they've been taken down. I mean, it's been 4 or 5 days. And, you know, for it just makes the product almost unusable for, you know.
Well, so the one thing I was told by, this was by somebody at one of the big tech companies who is interested in this topic and looking for solutions to it. And I said to her, why are you interested in this? Is this philanthropy? And, you know, she was funding a project to do with this. Is this philanthropy or, you know, why? And she said, well, no, actually, we are beginning to be worried about the health of the entire internet. You know, and if people are going to go onto Google and think, right, I'm not going to use it because what it turns up is fake, or I'm seeing it because of a Russian disinformation campaign, you know, then ultimately that's bad for Google or it's bad for Facebook. So it may be that there are commercial concerns that force companies to care about this eventually, but I'm just worried that it won't happen fast enough. Peter, you look like you wanted to say something.
I want to stick up for robots. so many of them are my followers.
You can't have as many as me.
So there's one of my heroes in this industry who I'm sure Gina knows, Tim Hwang, is a guy who started a movement called Pacific Social, which was trying to make an intellectual experiment at how realistic could you make bots. And he sort of started a competition among different groups, and they designed different types of bots which try to initiate conversations with different groups out there. And kind of, if I remember, like, the philosophy was, look, there's this, there's a lot of communities on Twitter who believe very damaging things about vaccines and, vaccines being bad for you, therefore you don't give them to your kids, and now there's like a flu epidemic in California. And so they want to see, could they use bots to engage some of these people? And one of the teams kind of put together a bot, which was a little bit like a Freudian bot. It would just go in and say, hello, how are you doing? That's interesting. Really? And then give the people some information. So anyway, this bot was so realistic that the guy, one of the people who was the leader of this sort of anti-vax movement in California, spent half a day trying to convert it to Christianity. The point I'm trying to get to is that can we use bots for something good? Because this bot managed to engage this guy and started by engaging him in a conversation, by listening, had started to go, well, have you thought about this? Here's some real information around this. I don't know. I remember seeing a presentation by Gilad Lotan, who's another big expert on these things, about how Palestinian and Israeli Twitter sphere has moved apart over the past sort of 5-6 years, more and more further away from each other. Again, Tim Hwang had this idea, like, okay, can we send a bot that machine learned very quickly? What are these things that these two different groups actually have in common? You know, obviously they hate each other around a lot of things, but are there areas that they have in common? And having done that analysis, could you automate bots that would start swapping bits of communication or bits of information between them that would encourage them to start communicating with each other? Anonymity, shmanimity, I can actually see when sometimes anonymity is very useful if you live in a dictatorship. But also, more important than that, instead of sort of running away in fear from robots, could we be training the robots to do something socially useful? I just don't know. Is anything like that happening that you know about, Joanna? Or?
Well, all I would say is that could be fine, but I think there's going to be a growing argument about the right to know. So if we think about what are the rights that you need in a digital bill of rights? Well, Baroness Kidron has done a pretty good job at setting down, you know, 5 core rights. One is the right to know, and one is the right to safety. So if you think about a third of internet users are children. You know, there is no way that you would let your kids wander into a place as lawless as the internet if it was outside your front door. And actually, there is something to be said for regulating in a way that allows us to create the internet as a safe place with rights like the right to know who, right to know who's using your data and for what, the right to know who is publishing what opinion and with what resource behind it, and the right to safety and support. Because, you know, if you were having this debate with some of my colleagues from the Women's PLP, you know, what they would tell you is that actually it's now impossible to use social media because of the level of abuse and hate. You know, that has a deeply, deeply damaging effect on the people who go into politics, who choose to go into politics. So these are huge issues for actually the health and well-being of our democracy.
Somewhat unfairly, although not entirely unfairly, since I see he's raising his hand, I'm going to call on someone who's working with us on one of our projects because he's thought a lot about anonymity and about some of these issues, and that's Edward Lucas, who's back there.
Thanks, Ali. I think it's really interesting we're focusing on this rather than what I think is the kind of rabbit hole of trying to decide what is bad content and what's good content. I think Joanna's absolutely right. We can't put the communication service providers, the tech companies, in the business of deciding what's allowed and what isn't. I think it's also worth remembering we didn't make a conscious decision that the central nervous system of modern life was going to be based on anonymity. When the internet was being sort of developed in the 70s and 80s, nobody said, hey, I've got this really good idea. You'll have no way of proving who you are and no way of ascertaining who you're dealing with. That just sort of crept up. And it's in our power to undo that. I think if it's not at the top of the tech company's hierarchy of priorities, it very soon will be. Because we need that level of identity assurance. And I think Twitter has already started to show the way. There could only be one Joanna Shields with a blue tick on Twitter. And I think that is the way forward. We need ways of showing that we're real, whether we get our banks to send an anonymized token that we want to authenticate ourselves, whether we do it through whatever government ID systems we have in different countries. But there are ways you could quite quickly build up a strong digital identity in your social media profile, which would then mean that you would stand behind the things you said. It would be much harder to come up with sort of hate tweets and hate speech. You would have the right to authenticate yourself. You'd also have the right to ask other people to authenticate themselves before you took seriously. And I think I would leave room for anonymity, just as we have room for Speaker's Corner. We have room for people who want to put masks on and go to masked balls in Venice or whatever. We have all sorts of, we have the right to write graffiti. Sometimes you have places in cities where there's a graffiti wall where you can go and write graffiti. But it isn't the normal setting. It's not, we don't authenticate. In the public sphere, we expect political speech to be authenticated. And I don't see why that should be different on the internet than it is in real life. And I'm worried about Peter's idea of getting into a kind of arms race of who's got the better bots, because I think that the our enemies will always be more unscrupulous than us, so they will tend to win. I would rather make it absolutely clear when you click on a link, you should get a little note saying this is going to a website that has deliberately concealed its identity. The who is intentionally obfuscated. There's no street address. There's no phone number. There's no. It may look real in terms of its design, but it has no characteristics of realness. And just as you get a warning from Google or from other people if you click on a link that's going to have malware, that's going to put malware on your computer, you should get a warning of lack of realness, and then it would be up to you whether you want to proceed or not. And it would be the same with the social media and email accounts. You would have either a blue tick or Twitter's golden key, or Facebook also now has blue and grey authentication signs. So I think the ingredients, what we need, are there, but it needs a lot of political will, and I suspect coming from big governments, to put pressure on the tech companies to make them do something that is ultimately in their own interest.
Yeah, I will add something to that. You know, the most of the advertising is automated. There's online systems where you go in and anybody can, you know, pick a set of characteristics and identify a very targeted class of people on these social platforms. And I think that those automated advertising systems have to be able to validate that someone is real and that they, you know, because because there's so much inventory and there's so many impressions, you can influence an enormous amount of people for a very small amount of money. So there has to be some way of verifying the identity or the validity of the people that are buying advertising to know that they are, you know, legitimate.
So this brings me actually to something else, which is the question of why the tech companies can't be made essentially to conform to existing law. So there is an existing law about honesty in advertising, and it's different in different countries. There are also existing laws about libel. In some countries, and I'm not saying this is good or bad, but I mean, in Germany, there are very strong laws about hate speech. And, you know, it's very easy to violate all of them on the internet. And I know that the Germans have made recently an attempt to begin dealing with that by making Facebook responsible for taking down posts and sites which are deemed to violate German laws on hate speech. And so then the question is, you know, is our legal system able to keep up with the speed and the nature of internet transactions? Is this the way, is this one of the ways forward? What do you think, Liam?
I think over the next couple of months you're going to see the House of Commons hear a lot about the German exemplar. I think there's a lot in it.
But if it works, I mean, we'll see.
Yeah, if it works. But it's not just about the regulation on the social media firms. So if you look at the UK, so the Advertising Standards Authority regulates online and offline ads unless it's political. So the Advertising Standards Authority doesn't regulate political adverts. Ofcom regulates broadcasters, but doesn't regulate social media firms. The Electoral Commission can't insist on transparency around digital advertising if it's related to politics, and the ICO, the Information Commissioner, can look at data, but not kind of content. So basically, you've got a 20th century regulatory structure in Britain, which is hopeless. And so, alongside modernisation of the e-commerce directive, we're also going to have to overhaul that regulatory infrastructure as well. No question.
On the German thing, maybe later we have some people in the audience who are senior editors of German newspapers, and maybe they can tell us more later on about their experience with the regulatory structures put in Germany around hate speech and the internet. I'm all for, the internet probably needs a lot more regulation. It's happened very fast, so it would be weird if we didn't start regulating it. I do fear there's something a little bit nostalgic in this sense that a little bit of regulation is going to fix this. In Germany, I literally saw the German neo-Nazis migrate with splendid ease away from Facebook onto VKontakte, which is the Russian site, onto gab.i, on Discord, onto channels most normal people haven't heard of. They will innovate away from our regulation with wonderful ease. It's a transnational issue, and they're going to get around it. Unless we start behaving like the Chinese with firewalls, but is that really the place that we want to go? So regulation, yes, amazingly important. Ofcom, in the memorable phrase of one civil servant who I shan't aim, was set up to police nudity on Coronation Street. It wasn't set up to, monitor ISIS and Kremlin bots.
To be fair, it does a good job of that.
Very well. Coronation Street hasn't offended me in many years. The regulatory stuff I'd like to talk about more actually in a transnational European context, and maybe some of you can add to that. But again, this idea that regulation will fix this, I think is just not feasible. Now, I just got back from the Western Balkans, where disinformation is rife from everyone. It's the Russians are at it, the local neo-authoritarian or quasi-authoritarian regimes are at it. There's jihadi groups, and I met sort of with the people who were kind of the descendants of people in the Cold War who sort of fought the fights of human rights or fought the fights in the name of sort of accurate information and good journalism. And they largely felt completely out of sync. They hadn't adapted their brains and their methodologies and the way they reach people or try to get their messages out or try to make themselves feel important for the digital age. So there's a huge leap that civil society, the sort of almost redundant term that we keep on using, civil society has to take, I think, this massive step forward and start engaging with these things, which does mean, yes, going onto gab.i or going into these dank corners of Facebook and starting to engage with some of these groups.
I think that's, I mean, I just noticed that, you know, when I was researching my book on Islamic extremism about a year and a half ago, and I talked to social media firms, actually there was a kind of a presumption that regulation was just never going to arrive. And actually that is now different. So now, you know, people from Facebook tell me the company, the corporate stance is to lean into regulation, you know, and I think there is a sense that, you know, we are now at the beginning of a century when, you know, the regulation is just going to change and change and change as the world and tech moves on.
Anyway, let me take a couple of questions from the audience. I know that I know there are several people here who are involved in these issues in different ways, and you know, we'd love to hear from you. I meant to say that you're supposed to ask a question with a question mark at the end of it, but you know, short comments also welcome. So there's one there. So. And could you introduce yourselves, please, and wait for the microphone because we like it better that way. Sorry.
Hi, my name's Paulina Voyner, and I'm a social and tech kind of researcher. And I'm curious, I was really pleased to hear, I can't remember who.
So that was Edward Lucas of CICLA.
Contribution, yeah. And what I'm aware of right now is that there is increasingly more and more technology that's actually going to allow people to produce not only photographs, but videos of people saying whatever the hell they want them to say, and then publish that as valid content. So I'm curious if from a tech but also regulatory perspective, if you see, because it feels like that issue is getting more and more granular into the source as, and the spiraling escalation of one thing triggering a huge political overchange, I see this as a huge disruption to how to regulate what is real and what isn't in our reality.
And adding to that, I'm sure you've all heard about this deep fakes controversy where, you know, celebrities are so, using technology are made to look like they are part of this pornographic video, and it's you know, it's really scary because it's indistinguishable. You cannot identify that's a fake.
Can I have another one?
You can have another one if it's brief.
Yeah. So I'm also curious if there's any kind of movements that are happening. So something that I've seen in terms of polarization and peace resolution is that actually some of the things that are most effective is more human-based approaches rather than political or ideological or intellectual approaches, in fact, where through things like nonviolent communication or more somatic things, people are actually finding a way to be closer to each other, especially in the Israeli and Palestinian context. So that's another nugget.
Let me take a couple of other questions and brief comments before we have the response. Go ahead. And could you introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Stephen Harper. I'm a private investor. My question was more around the impact of the business model of social media companies on democracy. So if let's assume that we're able to solve the disinformation problem and identify robots, and we no longer have to worry about the nefarious players in social media. There's still the central issue that Peter referred to of the polarization effect of news and information being curated that has this polarizing effect. And if democracy by its very nature is that, you know, ugly sausage-making process of reaching compromise to create legislation, how is this impact of polarization that social media is creating impacting the democratic process itself?
It's happening right now.
Well, that's, let me take one more. One over here.
I just wanted to ask, people used to be force-fed regulated information by Walter Cronkite and people like that. When they have the choice to avoid that, research suggests that they do avoid it. What happens if people just don't want to know? They don't want good information.
Right. So I would say just about quickly on the polarization issue. I mean, we Peter and I both started out being interested in disinformation and in Russian disinformation campaigns in particular, and the discussion of that got us very quickly to this question of polarization because we understood that the disinformation worked by using polarization. So I see them as pretty intimately connected, and some of the you know, in an odd way, some of the solutions to disinformation, I think, are to do with fixing the problem of polarization. And anyway, Peter, would you like to comment on any of those?
They're kind of the same question. What if people don't want good information and polarization? I mean, we have to also be careful. I mean, we sometimes slide into blaming this all on polarization is down to many, many factors apart from media, and it's a question that media probably reinforces it. I know at the LSE that we have a lot of conversations about this. But clearly it's a factor. Maybe it crystallizes polarization that is already there and then stops any kind of communication developing. That's such a great question. What do people they just don't want it? It's very interesting. At the moment, I've been doing a lot of thinking about what the West used to call public diplomacy, which is how do you talk to whole populations, in my case, thinking about Russia and Ukraine, who don't want to listen to you. So back in the Cold War, we kind of reached out and talked to them about things they cared about, you know, about pop culture, about the Beatles, about jeans. Also, it's kind of easier because the Soviet Union was claiming to be this wonderful thing. And so you could reach people by saying, actually, here are the facts about the Soviet Union. And so facts mattered because, you know, we could show the difference between the reality and what the Soviets were saying. It's much harder now to talk to populations there in eastern Ukraine, for example, because people aren't saying, you know, they're just deeply cynical about everything. You know, you come to them with something, and they're exactly, you're just, you know, what about Iraq? You know, you lie as well. You're just corrupt as we are. It's not even that they don't want it, yeah? It's just that they, you know, that trust is completely broken. And there was also like, what good will it do us? Yeah, democracy might be a good thing, but like, so what? Yeah, you have problems with migrants and like whatever. So you really have to listen to them incredibly hard and find out what they really, really care about, which still relates to things where quality information matters. So in the bits of the world that I was talking about, it actually still really matters to them about issues pertaining to health. So it makes Russians and Ukrainians really angry that their corrupt elites go to their health treatment in Germany. So health is something they care about. They really care about how their old people are treated. So you have to find issues, and it's not just welfare, by the way. It could be stuff about, you know, what you might call the pursuit of happiness, yeah? The sense that you can realize yourself in life. So you have to really listen to people and understand what are their bits in their lives that they're not cynical and where information does actually make a difference. I think it's a really important argument to make because there's no a priori thing that, you know, democracy is great because, you know, we debate facts and come to, you know, an evidence-based conclusion. I mean, why should that be a better system? So you almost have to go back to starting point and say, no, facts are useful, you know, and they're going to make your lives better, which is a struggle because we started taking a lot of these things just for granted. And people are right. They are very, very cynical and very jaded. So, yeah, it's really going back to sort of the source and trying to understand what difference it can make.
So I was elected 14 years ago, and when I was elected, I had a majority of 450. It's now 31,000. The reason for that change really is because we have a discipline of doing residence meetings every month, where we just invite people for a cup of coffee and listen. And so the human-based approach is called politics. But politics is the art of living together. That's all it is. And so, you know, believe me, there are very few issues on which the British public won't have an argument with their elected representatives about. You know, whether that issue is kind of big or small. But you know, we do have to recognise that this issue is that this system, this new system, is driving democracy today. So I won't be the only one in here who is perplexed by the rise of Jacob Rees-Mogg. If you look at the money behind the interventions on Facebook, all becomes clear. But of course, once you get a certain profile on Twitter, once you get a certain traffic on Facebook, that will then get picked up by either the Daily Express or the Daily Mail, put on the front page, and once it's on the front page of the Daily Mail, it's on the Stay programme. So that is how that's how the editorial cycle works in this country. So actually, the case for digital literacy is not about our children. Actually, it's we need better digital literacy among the people who run the media in this country. I'm afraid.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I've been, over the number of years I've been in government, I've been working with a lot of civil society organizations, initially, you know, combating Islamist extremism, sectarianism, you know, far-right issues. And then you look at other harms and crimes on the internet, you know, whether it's child sexual exploitation, but you've got this multitude of civil society and charities that are operating within, you know, a breadth of their existence. They have no funding, no resources. And so we always talk about government, we talk about the companies, but, you know, if the companies are truly interested in fixing the harms and crimes that their platforms solve, I really believe that they need to look at building an ecosystem and connecting with civil society at groups and charities and understanding the problem of victims and really, really getting deep into the issues and owning that problem and trying to solve it in society. You know, in the past, you know, if you look at the robber barons or you look at the, you know, the Industrial Revolution, those who had the economic power were in the business of making sure that the people in general were happy in some sense. They built communities, health centers, you know, schools and various other things. And, you know, when you're generating that much wealth and it's disproportionate, there is an opportunity to really own the problem and give back to the community. And I think that that would make a huge difference, because understanding the problem, then you could apply the technology. You know, these platforms are black boxes. There's no way that a government can regulate it and get it right.
Yeah.
I mean, it'll be a constant state of tinkering,
It's such a brilliant point. I mean, you know, if you look back on the great ethical capitalists of this country, if you think about George Cabry or William Lever or John Speen Lewis, you know, they didn't just build great companies, they built great cities. You know, look at Bourneville, look at Port Sunlight. And, you know, I say this to friends in Google, you know, who tell me about their great work doing Google Garage. And Google Garage is indeed a virtuous thing, but it's not Bourneville and it ain't Port Sunlight.
No.
You know, so actually we need to kind of rediscover some ethical capitalist traditions here.
Yeah, and by the way, we've focused quite a lot on, you know, the tech companies and the government, because we have the two of you here. I mean, I'm very much a believer in the small groups, the civic institutions, the academics, and journalists who are also going to be part of solving this problem. And I think one of the difficulties with this is I don't think there's a silver bullet solution. I mean, I like your image of, you know, we're just going to keep writing and rewriting laws and we're going to and keep working on it, you know, for the next 100 years, because I don't think there's going to be one answer. There are going to be multiple answers in multiple fields.
Yeah, I agree.
So anyway, maybe one more round of questions, since I don't want to. John Lloyd of Reuters and FT.
John Lloyd, there was a strain of pessimism in what Peter was saying, and also what Joanna was saying. One, Peter was saying, whatever regulation you have, they can get around it if they really want to. Joanna was saying that Facebook has 200 million fake sites. And you said it can't do anything even if it wants to. So is there a kind of a zero-sum game here, that to be effective, you need to have quite strict regulation? And the stricter the regulation or the laws, the less there is of what we regard now as free speech. In this context, I thought Liam was getting close to saying that there's a real problem about Facebook and Twitter and so on, and that if it gets worse, we have to find some way of keeping Jacob Rees-Mogg off the front page of the Daily Mail.
No, I'm not sure any of us could boast that power.
That was the suggestion. I know, I'm sure you're meaning it, but nevertheless, it was a suggestion. And though you were impeccably for free speech, that's the way things might go.
But there isn't an unfettered right to free speech. It's not unfettered. There are always, you know, it's shouting fire in a crowded theatre. But I think the reason change is coming is that people want it. So, you know, when I do schoolgate surgeries on a Friday afternoon at sort of 3 o'clock, I have mums poking me in the chest, asking me what I'm doing about social media firms, who are kind of influencing their children in dangerous ways. I mean, this is now a doorstep issue in a way that it wasn't even 18 months ago. It's just shot up there in a really significant way. So that's what I mean. I don't think sort of rewriting the e-commerce directive endlessly is the whole answer either. I think it is a piece of the puzzle. But the reason I talk about rewriting is because I think we actually have to proceed with incredible caution. You know, actually, what we don't want is a social media regulatory regime that looks like China's or indeed Russia's. Actually, we do want to protect the free speech traditions that we've got. In fact, what we're trying to do is protect it, because at the moment, the misuse of those social media platforms is driving some people and some communities, particularly women, out of social media platforms today. We had a Tory MP today say that she's just had to leave Twitter because she just can't take the abuse and the death threats anymore. So how do we protect it and enhance it for all, not just for a few?
Just this is not my idea. Researcher at the think tank next to Google told me this, and I don't necessarily agree with the researcher, but this was his or her thesis, that in the sort of harassment online world, you have all these sort of anonymous or non-anonymous accounts threatening people, often with death threats, but always never quite getting to the point where they're like, you know, really breaking the law by like, you know, I will come around in half an hour and shoot you. And whenever you try to push back, they go, no, it's free speech. It's okay for me to threaten this person and humiliate them and denigrate them. So her idea was actually what they're doing is a form of censorship. Hmm. They're shutting up the person that they're targeting. Their aim is to throw them off the internet.
That's
also, an even more provocative idea, disinformation, when it's used by authoritarian regimes, when they can't censor as effectively as they used to, they just pour the ground with so much disinformation, you can't tell what are real facts and what is disingenuous. That also is a form of censorship. Now, it's a provocative argument, but it puts, you know, the free speech censorship equation on its head, where suddenly harassment is a form of censorship, where disinformation is a form of censorship. Again, very provocative, legally very complex, but I thought they're quite interesting ideas to kind of throw into the mix.
Okay. Let's take a couple more questions. We don't have that much more time, so... I was looking for someone female, actually. There's one right here, and then there's one. So.
Yeah, well, this is my life now.
Thanks. Yaroslav Barbieri and Karin Tanin for the Russia Eurasia program at Chatham House. I have a small question and a small suggestion, I guess. My question is that I've been working a lot on also the misinformation, say, or historical facts, so not just information, but I would be curious in hearing your opinion on how to fight the spread of, say, misinformation about, like, history facts, because that is something more complex to fight. And, like, especially I've been studying this in the context of Ukraine and Russia. And the suggestion is that there's actually a lot of research from experimental psychology about the individual level of reaction to, say, how we tend to select sources that, say, reinforce our pre-existing biases. And so, say, if I am exposed to sources that actually contradict my convictions, they're actually going to be reinforced rather than challenged. So maybe if you were thinking of expanding, like, part of your project in including this type of research. Thanks.
Funnily enough,
that's something,
that's occurred to us. Yeah. No, there are ways, and there are a lot of different kinds of people who are working on this, where you could almost give a kind of score to certain kinds of websites or news outlets, depending on all kinds of factors, like do they use double sourcing? Do they, you know, are they transparent about who owns them? You know, you could begin to think about it, and those are, you know, you could use several dozen, even more, factors that would give you a kind of rating for different news sources. And there are a number of people now playing with that. You know, could you do a ranking? Could you do an index? Could you measure somehow credibility? And we are part of, there are a number of people kicking that idea around, and we are part of one of those projects. And it actually, funny enough, works particularly well in a place like Ukraine, where you have dozens of news organizations and sites with different kinds of agendas, and where that might actually help people. It works a little bit less well here for other reasons, but yeah, that's one of the other paths that we're looking at pursuing. Let me take a couple more. It's almost 8 o'clock now, so there's one there, sorry, and then one there. So, yep.
Hi, my name is Vincent Kamerling. I very interesting debate, and I'm sure that the answer lies in a multiple of solutions, and I believe in very much that it's a human right of free speech, but that means also you have to be able to identify yourself, and I think that's probably one of the areas that I would very much support personally. But disinformation for me is also providing information, and I do think that there is another opportunity perhaps, both for the press, the recognized media, to perhaps provide more information when there is disinformation. For me personally, and I'm from Belgium, I live 30 years in this country, the Brexit debate comes to mind. I found that the quality provided regarding Brexit, the pros and cons by all the different universes were actually very poor. Yeah. And did not facilitate for people to come to some kind of a very complex issue, you know, at least some kind of well-presented pros and cons, and then make the decision. So I do think that there is perhaps an important role at this point of time for information to be reignited and restart, and perhaps say, how can we better inform people so that they are aware that there is disinformation? And perhaps counter to a certain extent the bad news with perhaps trying to be more objective and also avoiding by itself the fake news. A lot of politicians today are using the fake news as a kind of an argument. You're not helping yourself, not helping yourself by doing this.
Yeah, so another one of the solutions that people talk about a lot. I mean, first of all, there's an obvious solution, which is better journalism, and that can mean a lot of different things, including journalism that takes into account the different nature of different kinds of audiences. Fact-checking and fact-checking websites were one of the first responses, actually beginning some years back. Particularly in not only in this country but also in Central Europe and elsewhere. And the trouble turned out to be, as one of the previous questioners noted, that not everybody trusted the fact-checking websites and that not everybody accepted so-called facts unless they came from some ideologically compatible source. And so, you know, the nature of, you know, how you provide people information that they no is not only everybody agrees that it's correct, and also it's something that people accept and trust is quite complicated. Do any of you want to comment to either of those points?
Well, it does just remind me of how difficult it is to actually become a journalist. I mean, it's it's a pretty thankless phase in your early career. It's expensive, it's risky. I think I need to think about this a bit more. I mean, the way that we fund through bursaries, scholarships, other opportunities, the development of journalism is actually something I don't think we've thought about in the commons certainly very much. That's a good thing for us to take away.
I think no matter how good journalism is lately, the opinions, the hyper-partisan opinions are hardening. I heard in a news report last night that I trust that 70% of Republicans now in the United States have a negative opinion of the FBI, which is, I mean, as someone who grew up in the United States, it's a profound change. It was always the Law and Order Party. It was always the party that was, you know, for much more surveillance and it's just beyond comprehension that in such a short period of time that you could have an entire class or a political party that's, you know, now has a negative opinion of law enforcement. So I think no matter how good the journalism is, it's not cutting through. You know, these hyper-partisan groups are hardening and not hearing outside news. You hear, you know, respected politicians, you know, parroting this misinformation, and it's quite disturbing.
Or unrespected politicians.
Yes. Yeah,
as the case may be. Disrespected politicians. Okay, let's take, sorry, this is obnoxious because I now see tons of hands, but let's take randomly there and there as two more, and then we are going to invite you all to come and have a drink with us, and you can ask more questions.
Hi, my name is Jonathan Friedman. I work in corporate intelligence, so plenty of crossover with these issues that we're talking about. One thing I found interesting, we talked a lot about social media, and we had one of a fellow members of the audience talking about the debate here over leaving the EU, of course, in the U.S., Trump. Overwhelmingly, the people who supported what we might consider to these types of issues that are fueled somewhat by bad information are older voters who don't really use much social media. Actually, most of their information is from television. Most work I do is folks in Turkey. Again, the least informed people tend to be people who get their news from traditional news sources. The best informed people are people who are on social media. I'd like to just to hear your thoughts on that kind of paradox and what role traditional media, I think you mentioned a bit, Liam, is actually playing and fueling a lot of this issue.
Okay, let's take one other, and then we'll have final responses since it's almost 8 o'clock.
My name is Christine Chow. I'm an institutional investor representative in my day job, but I'm also a lay governor of the LSE. I'm particularly interested in Joanna's suggestion on building an ecosystem and getting companies to talk to victims, because I've been involved in my engagement work in dealing with ecosystems. And when we ask companies to work with NGOs, to work with media, to work with investors, a lot of problems surface because they are pulled in all different directions. In order to make something with a multi-stakeholder work, you need someone who will really be at the anchor of the whole system. And it doesn't sound like that companies or social media companies are convinced enough that this is a critical or material enough issue. And I want to finish off by giving an example. I was speaking at the UN, at the UN Business and Human Rights Forum. And we have 200 people talking about human rights issues in cobalt supply chain. And this woman stood up and said, none of you have visited. I come from Congo. None of you have any idea what's going on there. And everyone was shocked. So from the company's perspective, if I were going to engage with the board or the management of Facebook and Google, what can we ask them? How can we convince them this is a material issue? And what would you recommend, please?
So, final comments on either of those two questions. Peter, looked like you wanted to say something.
The question about sort of TV and digital reminds me a lot of the questions about Yeltsin and Putin. It's like, you know, was Yeltsin different to Putin, or was it actually a continuation of? I think it's a continuation of. I think digital media already, cable news already started segmenting people and creating more space for polarization. Digital media is now finishing off the job. So Yeltsin started the corruption in Russia and Putin finished it off. There's a very interesting study by MIT, though, about how Fox News has changed over the election cycle. And it was incredible. Breitbart started, so the digital meter, Breitbart was attacking Fox News over and over and over, saying, I'm quoting them, you're conservatives. Still haven't quite worked out what that means. But whatever, saying you're soft, you're corrupt, you're backing Rubio. And Fox had to adjust itself and become more and more partisan and right wing. And then they hired Tucker Carlson, who once was not so crazy either. And Fox News, or bits of Fox News, the most important bits of Fox News, the primetime bits, start to swing towards Breitbart. So look, it's an ecology. It's not like, here is the good legacy media and along comes bad digital media. It's this kind of sliding scale of Yeltsin through to Putin. Yeah. Bringing some Russian stuff in there. Sorry.
This is really important because you've got to understand that ecosystem that includes TV as well as newspapers and online. So, you know, the advent of these fake news sites or suspicious news sites, whether it's Breitbart or whether it's Canary on the left, you know, that is definitely influencing the way in which political correspondents and others cover things on telly, which is then getting translated through newspapers. But what a lot of newspapers are now doing is they're almost looking at social media as a way of kind of A-B testing different stories to see actually what has got the most traction. And what they're vulnerable to is dark money switching behinds to gain paid-for traction behind stories, which will then be misinterpreted as popularity, and then it will be on the front page of newspapers, which then will then drive a TV agenda. So it is an ecosystem that you've definitely got to look at. But I think the point I guess I wanted to finish at is John Loy's point really, which is that we have this responsibility in politics too, and I hope that you can do this at ARENA. But it is actually to be the techno-optimist here. You know, technology, if we're in the LSE, it's appropriate to quote Beveridge, I suppose. I mean, if you think about the five giants of social injustice that Beveridge talked about, want, squalor, idleness, ignorance, and disease, I mean, we've actually got to do a much better job at arguing about how tech can actually help transform those injustices of today with the possibilities of tomorrow. And I'll finish with a very small plug, which is that if you want to get involved in helping shape that debate and the policy that we are talking about, jump onto peoplesplan.co.uk, which is the first attempt by a parliamentarian to do open source policy making in a way that affects things actually in the House of Commons.
So what's it called, People's Plan?
peoplesplan.co.uk, yeah, okay. So.
I gave him a chance to say it twice.
Do you want a last word?
Well, I just, you know, responding to what is it going to take for the companies to get engaged, I think it is sincere that, you know, Mark's commitment to fixing Facebook this year is a sincere commitment. And I think it's a process. It will be a trial and error thing. They're starting to, you know, surface more stories that are actually from your real friends versus these are that are bot-driven, sort of algorithmically hyped stories. And it's going to be a bit of trial and error, but they have some of the smartest people in the world. And I think that there will be improvements to the system. And but again, just to stay ahead of this, because the technology's sort of taken over. You know, the bots have taken over in some sense. That's why I really believe that it's critically important that companies begin to understand the needs of their users and to, rather than just, you know, operate in a crisis management construct where every time there's a story, they come up with a plan and respond to that particular, you know, horrific account, that they actually, you know, think about how do they solve these problems on a fundamental basis. You know, working with charities and civil society and victims to solve cyberbullying, you know, extremism, all these, this dopamine sort of emotionally driven, narcissistic kind of impact that it's having on children and, you know, keeping extreme porn from younger users. I mean, there's so many things that they have to work on, but they can't avoid any of them because the public is starting to demand response.
Right. Well, thank you particularly to Liam and to Joanna, who took off their political hats a little bit to have this very bipartisan and friendly debate. Thank you all for coming. This is an issue that's not going away. We're going to continue talking and writing about it. You can find when we do produce things, they'll be on our website.